There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, I'm so glad that you can join me for a little classic cardboard conversation. And I should probably trademark that phrase. I've been dropping that into the beginning of the show for a lot of shows here. But now we'll leave the trademark open for now and have some classic cardboard conversation. Although this episode, we're not really talking about classic cardboard. There is some cardboard here. It's classic in the sense that it's old. You know, I guess vintage would be the better terminology there. But I think the key word for the two items that we are looking at in this podcast is fun. And collecting sports cards, or really any collectible, it should be fun. Because think about it. When you started collecting cards, whenever that was, you know, when you were a elementary school student, maybe a teenager, or maybe you've only just gotten into it. You started collecting just a few years ago. You start with fun. And even as the hobby became a business in the mid to late 80s and started spiraling out of control in the 90s, and in a day and age now where you're looking at some of your more valuable cards thinking, should I send this off to get graded? Nobody really gets into the hobby with the notion of making money. Yeah, you can make money. You can turn a profit on some of these cards. But let's be honest, unless you've got some incredible cards dropped into your lap that you had no investment on before. And I'm talking 52 Topps Mantle. I'm talking, you know, Hank Aaron and Willie Mays and Honus Wagner rookie cards. You know, unless you've got those gems in great condition just thrown at you, there are better ways, easier ways to make money than mining collections of sports cards. I mean, become a real estate agent if you want to make money. Get into trading stocks if you just want to make money. You really don't get into the hobby to make money. That shouldn't be your primary reason. I would imagine, and probably 99.8% of the people who are in the hobby or who were in the hobby, maybe you don't collect now, but you did back in the day. The primary reason why you got in and what really got you going before you realized, oh yeah, I could make a few bucks off this, it was fun. And that's it. It's fun. It was fun when you were a kid. It was a fun distraction from all the pressures of teenage, prepubescent life when you were, 11, 12, 13 years old. It's a pleasant distraction now from the COVID crisis that this nation and world is still dealing with, from political yelling and screaming and kicking and crying, all the nonsense that we're dealing with now. It's just so fun to open up a pack of cards, even if it isn't a pack of cards that is going to pay the mortgage. You know what I'm talking about. You get that cello pack of 88 tops just sitting around, and you know there's probably not one single card in there that is book value more than 75 cents. It's fun. You open it up. You get that toxic smell of cardboard and bubble gum and wax. Well, if it's a cello pack, you don't get the wax smell, but you get my point. You get the smell. You get to see the names of the players you used to watch. you get to see some of the superstars of the day, some of the big rookies. You're flooded with memories of whatever you were doing back in 1988 in that case. It's fun. And I think in a day where the hobby is doing very well right now, and in part because of COVID, because more and more people in trying to find ways to occupy their time during lockdowns over the last several months, either went back through their collections that they had just kind of neglected and kind of put off in a box or a folder somewhere in a corner. They went back through it. Maybe they purchased some cards online. Maybe they introduced their kids or their grandkids to the hobby. You know, the hobby is doing very well right now. And even though the focus of the hobby is on high quality cards, refractor cards, variation cards, you're still not getting a pack of new cards for under $2. Even though you're looking at high quality, premium, sometimes limited edition cards, and the industry is doing well, I think there's still an element of fun that is missing from today's cards. Now, that is not to say that opening up a new pack of cards or a box of cards is not fun. Quite the contrary. Yes, you're paying more for these cards. Yes, you're getting fewer cards per pack than you did 30 or 40 years ago. But there is still a thrill of whether you're going to a card show or your local hobby shop and buying either a few packs or a box of cards, or if you're going the retailer route, you're going to Target, you're going to Walmart, you're buying one of those 7 or 8 pack blaster boxes for $10. There is still a thrill of opening up packs of cards, seeing what's inside, seeing if you get any surprise inserts or big rookies or Hall of Fame players, sharing it with the ones you love, whether it's your son or daughter or your grandkids or maybe your significant other collects as well, or just being selfish. Hey, I survived COVID this week. I still have a job. I still have some disposable income. What the hell? Let me go drop $20 at Walmart on a box of cards because damn it, I deserve it. You know, it's that guilty pleasure. Some people buy, you know, big sugary frothy cappuccinos at Starbucks as a treat. Others go out and have a few beers. And, you know, some of us, we just say, screw it. I'm going to go get a box of cards. There's still fun in the cards, but it's obviously a different type of fun. And I'm not just talking about, yeah, it was cheaper back then and you typically got more cards in the pack. There was a just kind of an innocent fun to collectibles back in the 70s and 80s. And we're looking at two of those really fun collectibles. Starting off with an item from 1979, I had 4 pieces of Topps chewing gum, although it was branded as Major League Baseball gum. It was manufactured by the Topps Chewing Gum Company, which once upon a time manufactured my favorite chewing gum of all time, Bazooka Joe. I used to buy boxes of that. Got a lot of cavities out of it, but I loved that Bazooka Joe bubble gum. And the 1979 Major League Baseball / Topps bubblegum was not only just a nice co-op branded piece of confectionery delight. Wrapped around each little brick of pink sugary goodness was a wrapper featuring a comic book stylization of all-star players from the 1978 season. It was a very unique set of 33 wrappers. And I've mentioned this before, basically the all-star wrapper replaced the Bazooka Joe comic. If you remember those Bazooka Joe pieces, you'd open the wrapper and wrapped around the gum, kind of like an interior wrapper, was the comic. You'd open it up and sometimes you'd laugh, other times you would just groan. But That's basically what Topps did. They pretty much doubled the size of the Bazooka Joe comic. And on this square wrapper, roughly 2 inches by 2 inches, you had a pretty neat one-panel comic of the player with a small little insert featuring a rule of baseball. So it wasn't just, an entertaining piece of material. It was educational, too. And think of the target market. I mean, if you've got 7, 8-year-old kids who are, you know, opening up this bubble gum, they have a chance to learn about the sport of baseball while they're chewing on this gum. So it was a very smart thing for both Major League Baseball and for the Topps Chewing Gum Company to make. And this is just one of those mystifying things that Topps did right around that same time, where in the effort to increase revenue streams and diversify their products a little bit and to try to head off at the pass the soon incoming competition, notably from Fleer, but ultimately from Fleer and Donruss and then other companies in the mid to late 80s, Topps somehow took a very good idea and just stopped doing it. And I don't understand why. So we'll get into that and some of the things that Topps was trying to do a little later on. That is item number one, the 1979 Topps baseball bubblegum. And then item number two is another fun item. There were a few sets of these created in the mid-1980s. Donruss figured the best way to make something fun was to make it big. And you could argue unnecessarily big. Now, we've talked about the Topps big baseball cards. That was the nod from 1988 to 1990 of the style of cards that Topps made in the mid-50s. In fact, it's pretty much a dead ringer for a modernized version of the 1956 Topps set. Certainly the 1988 set is. Topps kind of let the creative control get out of hand in 89 and 90. But the only thing that made the Topps big cards big was the slightly, and we're talking eighths of an inch larger size card. It matched the size of the Topps baseball card pre-1957. The Donruss big cards were essentially postcards of baseball cards. They were 3x5 cards, or rather, 3x5 cards. I was going to say 5x8. That's a little too big. They were 3x5 cards, and they were basically all-star inserts. And what started as kind of a gaudy jumbo size all-star subset in 1983 turned into a pretty consistent product that somewhat mirrored the base set that Donruss was putting out. But in 1987, Donruss figured, wait, we can't just make it big to make it fun. Let's make it pop up too. Yes, appealing to the three-year-old literature that we took in as toddlers, Donruss inserted not just three postcard-sized baseball cards and three complementary pieces to the Roberto Clemente Perez Steele puzzle that was part of the 1987 base set, but it also inserted the fold here, pull here, tuck in tabs there, or tuck in tabs there, pop-up all-star card, where if you folded the pop-up cardboard properly, you had your favorite player, or in the case of a couple of the packs we opened, your favorite dreaded manager, in somewhat of a 3D mode with the backlit roof of the Houston Astrodome in the background. And it was actually a pretty neat little trick. It is the ultimate tchotchke that you could insert into a pack of baseball cards. And I remember buying one of those back probably in 1990, 91, somewhere around there. And I got a Cal Ripken Jr. pop-up out of it. And it may still be in my collection somewhere or in my mom's house. I don't know. But the funny thing is, as I was opening up the pop-up All-Star cards for our video break, which if you didn't see the link on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, so you could just search YouTube, Wax Ecstatic Donruss Pop-Ups and Major League Baseball Gum, or I think it's MLB Gum is what we title it. You'll see that one of the four pop-ups that I get is Cal Ripken Jr. So it all circles back to fun, doesn't it? What was fun for me to open up about 30 years ago was fun for me to open up again. And even though I'm not a huge fan of the Donruss big all-star cards, you know, I've always had trouble figuring out, well, what do you do with these? I still had a lot of fun flipping through some of these cards and reconnecting on some of the names. And a lot of these I actually gave to my son, and he enjoyed it. So he's got a couple pop-ups and a few of the rather large cards sitting on his dresser right now, along with stacks and stacks of other baseball cards I've passed along to him. And to talk a little bit about the Donruss big all-star sets, like I said, there were a few of these subsets in the 1980s. We are pleased to have Mike Sommer from WaxPackHero.com joining us here in just a little bit. He will give you some more detail about those Donruss big sets from the mid-1980s and some of the fun things about it. He is, dare I say, not only a connoisseur of the big sets from Donruss, but also an expert, because he's somebody who has collected each card from all sets. And, you know, that's the fun thing about some of these subsets. While some people are take it or leave it, if you take the time to invest in some of these quirky little subsets, you're going to enjoy them. And I can tell you just by opening up some of the bubblegum pieces, yeah, that may be something that I venture out to try to collect too. And they are fairly, you know, readily available, although it will cost you a pretty penny if you're trying to put together a complete set, because it's just simply something that's over 40 years old. So it is kind of in that vintage category. So we'll get into greater detail of the Donruss big cards with Mike Sommer of WaxPackHero.com later on. I'll also provide some more information about the gum wrappers as well, as we're going to have a lot of fun just talking about, again, those generally speaking fun topics there on this week's podcast. Now, I would like to remind you that we have a Wax Ecstatic coming your way every other week, and our next show will be coming out Friday, November the 9th, so 2 weeks from now. I already have a couple of products lined up for that show as well, and this was, again, one of those accidental inspirations into the show. It tends to happen, as my good friend Coach Mike, Mike McLaughlin, was at a card show recently, picked up a few extra goodies here and there. We were trading some supplies and cards back and forth recently, and amongst the miscellaneous goodies that he just kind of tossed in a box for me were a few packs of 91 Score, 92 Leaf, and 91 Leaf Studio. And I am very proud to say that we will not have a show about 91 Score. That is of the bloated sets of the early 1990s. 91 Score is the bloatiest of bloated, coming in at well over 900 cards. Just an unnecessarily huge set. And I did open the packs just for the hell of it and you know, saw some familiar names. And I still kind of marvel at the design of 91 Score. It has a very 1991 look to it, but not a lot of collectors are clamoring to remember the days of 91 Score. However, the Leaf Studio and the Leaf cards from 1992... we will dive into just a little bit. I do recall bringing up 92 Leaf in a show. We did a random pack assortment show not that long ago, about a year ago. And I believe there was some 92 Leaf in there. So it's been brought up before, but we'll take a second look at it. I'm really more interested in the Leaf Studio. That was one of those premium sets that came out in the early 1990s that really was a difference-making set. And not in the way of like Upper Deck in 89 or Stadium Club in 91, where it kind of turned the hobby on its ear. I think what it did, though, was make baseball cards and the players associated on them a little more human, and certainly with a nice artistic touch. So we'll discuss that in our next program. Again, the Leaf Studio and the 92 Leaf packs. I got two packs of each. We'll bring those up in the next podcast, which again will be Friday, November the 9th. And then after that, we'll see what comes down the pipe. Thanks to your donations. We've picked up a few donations here and there, cash donations via PayPal at paypal.me/waxecstatic. We got a few bucks in the bank account, and we will do some eBay shopping, and I haven't quite ventured out to the card shows yet. Yes, the card shows are back and running here in Tampa, Florida, where I am, but also coronavirus, thanks to our intrepidly stupid governor, Ron DeSantis, it's on the rise again. So me personally, I'm still not crazy about going into enclosed places with the large audiences of people. Even if you're wearing a mask, I still get a little edgy. And you know, some of the people that frequent these card shows, they haven't washed their hands in about 3 years. So, you know, I'm still playing it safe right now, but we will see what is found online and hopefully have a nice little mix of vintage, a nice little mix of some 80s and 90s stuff, and some off the wall stuff as well, like we've had over the last few shows. Now, if you would like to make a cardboard donation, we certainly appreciate those. I've received a couple of those recently. If you have made a cardboard donation, thank you so much. Whether it's just something to help add to my personal collection, some of you have done that. Some of you have sent cards or have asked for checklist from me. I'm working on a lot of top sets from 1975 to 86 right now. And a lot of you have stepped forward offering to help fill those sets. So thank you for doing that. But if you want to make a cardboard donation, even if it's a product that we're going to discuss on the show, and we've done that in the past, you can do so. Just simply email me, Matt Salmon Says, that's MattSammonSez @gmail.com. Let me know what you're thinking. And if it sounds like something that would benefit the show and perhaps get a little bit of cardboard off of your hands, I'm certainly more than willing to do that. And we can try to work something out. And also, don't forget that our Twitter timeline is open 24/7 at Wax and Gum Stains. A lot of great commentary over the last couple of weeks. John Williams sharing with us a rather unique baseball that he purchased on eBay, was asking for our feedback on it. My best guess, it was a promotional ball from Rawlings from 1977. And that was the first year that Rawlings was the official baseball manufacturer for Major League Baseball. For decades, Major League Baseball had an agreement with Spalding. But in 1977, Rawlings became the official ball. And John picked up a really cool autographed ball that was stamped. It was basically a little promotional gift. And it's a pretty cool thing that you can add to your collection. Topps Pursuit also sending us a picture of something he found at a local card show. And he said, thanks to Wax Ecstatic, he did not buy it. What was that item? It was the Foback Rack Pack. Yes, the Merry Christmas Santa Rack Packs. We opened up one featuring some 1979 Topps cards a few months back. This one featured, I believe it was 78 cards, or it might have been 76. But anyways, one of those mid-70s Rack Packs, and the dealer was selling it for $50. And just by looking at the cards that were on top, I figured that they might be $10 to $15 worth of cards inside there, but best buyer beware with those Foback Rack Packs. So we are very glad that we jumped on that sword and helped you out there, Topps Pursuit. You don't want to waste your money on stuff like that. Now, Brian Krause chiming in on our most recent podcast regarding the minor league baseball cards. In particular, we were looking at the 1991 Classic minor league cards. And Brian says, enjoy the latest podcast. Your mention of the Portland Beavers reminded me of when minor league hats became the thing. And I managed to purchase that hat. Yeah, minor league baseball, and this is part of the success that minor league baseball was showing in the late 80s and early 90s. The clothing of minor league baseball suddenly became very popular. And yeah, early to mid 90s, I remember minor league hats were a big thing too. And one of the first ones I got my hands on, and I still have it, is the Carolina Mudcats. I always thought the Carolina Mudcats just had one of the best hats in minor league baseball. The Chattanooga Lookouts. I've got a retro Lookouts jersey from Ebbets Field Flannels. Love the Chattanooga Lookouts. And what was the other cap I had? I donated it years ago. The Capital City Bombers. I think they were based in Maryland, if I remember correctly. But they had this World War II era looking bomber and just kind of a color scheme. It was a very, very cool look there. But thank you very much, Brian, for listening and for your comments on the minor league cards. Speaking of minor league cards and minor leaguers who didn't quite make the cut, yes, Todd Van Poppel getting a little love from our friends at Commons for Kids, as Commons for Kids found a plethora of Todd Van Poppel cards in a recent donation. Let me see here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Looks like about 25, 91 Upper Deck Todd Van Poppels. And Commons for Kids saying, yeah, we hit the jackpot. And Brian Kilby tagging us too, going, yeah, Todd Van Poppel also getting a mention on the latest episode of Wax and Gum Stains. He was one of the most notable names in the 91 Classic Best minor league set, although in the end, certainly not one of the more valuable ones. Certainly taking a back seat to Chipper Jones and Pedro Martinez and Ivan Rodriguez, amongst other names, Jim Tomei, Tim Salmon, a whole bunch of others. So that's one of the fun things about looking back at minor league cards there. And also Iowa's Joe Crawford sending us a picture of a complete set that he purchased, said picked up after listening to the last episode of Wax Ecstatic. Nice set and super inexpensive. And that is, again, one of the neat things when you go, you know, plumbing through some of your older cards, or you go looking through some of the cards that you've forgotten about over the years. And the 91 Classic minor league set, even with those incredible names, because it did come out in 1991, and it was largely massively produced. And also the quality of the cards were not that great. Think the 81 Donruss flimsiness. Yeah, that kind of cardboard, that's what you had in the 91 Classic minor league card set. So that kind of brought down the price too. And of course, you know, investor collector enthusiasm was not very high as the minor league market got flooded as well. But the good thing is that if you want minor league cards of some Hall of Fame players and some memorable names, and of course the Mike Schmidt inserts that are in there, whether you buy the complete set or if you buy a few packs here or there, they're still very affordable. Nice cards, fun set to collect. And speaking of memorable names, some memorable minor league baseball teams are in there as well. Some legendary names. You know, I mentioned the Chattanooga Lookouts, but, you know, you've got your Hagerstown Suns, for example, your San Antonio Missions, your Pawtucket Red Sox. So it's always fun to kind of look through that as well. One more quick thing, whether it's cardboard donations or cash donations, remember, everything goes around full circle with Wax Ecstatic. cardboard donations. If we have excess product, we make sure that our friends at Commons for Kids get those cards as well to pass along to kids who are dealing with tough times these days, whether it's health issues or bad family situations, or just a tough financial situation. You know, nothing brings a smile to a kid's face like just connecting them with something fun, something like sports cards, even non-sports cards. And also, if you make a cash donation, that money is used in one of two ways. One, it goes back to just maintaining the audio boom feed that we have for this podcast, keeping our archives free for our listeners, but also purchasing those products. As I mentioned, we've picked up a few dollars recently, so we'll go shopping soon. But also, again, if we have any excess product from what we purchase, that too goes to Commons for Kids. I promise I'm going to get to sending a rather large shipment of cards, featuring cards going back to the mid-70s up until some that were just 2-3 years old. So we're going to be getting that out there. I've got to find the right size box, though, because the Postal Service no longer gives you the flat rate board game size box. They used to do that, and that was great because you could slide in a few 800 count boxes, and for a grand total of like $18, you could mail that thing off. Well, they don't do that anymore. There's only so many 400 count boxes you can cram into the quote unquote large priority mailbox. So I've got to find the right box, make sure that these cards get to Commons for Kids safely. But if you would like to donate to Commons for Kids, you can find out how to on Twitter. Their handle is Commons for Kids. That's the number 4, Commons for Kids, and check them out. Now, speaking of checking things out, before we check out the Donruss Big Cards with our friend Mike Summer, we're going to take one more quick look at the Topps chewing gum wrappers. And again, these were some really neat wrappers, these comic book variations of All-Star baseball cards, if you will. Just a one-panel comic book treatment to some top players. Some of the players that we got in the four packs that we opened: Reggie Smith and Ross Grimsley, who we'll be talking about later on in the program when we look back at some of the cards that we pulled and give you a little biographical information. But also we had J.R. Richard, who really pops in his Tequila Sunrise Houston Astros jersey on that wax wrapper, and Steve Garvey. And I had totally forgotten that Steve Garvey and Reggie Smith once upon a time duked it out in the Dodger locker room because I believe it was Don Sutton who, you know, publicly said Reggie Smith is the best player in our team. And Steve Garvey, who had a slight ego, didn't take kindly to those words, so they started throwing hands. I think it was in 1981, I want to say. Sometimes the artful Dodgers were not too artful. You did have some egos in that locker room back in the day. But it was neat to see these four players in this bubblegum wrapper presentation. As I said before, basically 2-inch by 2-inch wax squares. And what's interesting about these wax wrappers is that Topps didn't do this again. There was only one year, one set, 33 total wrappers, and that was it. And I thought this would actually be a rather unique way of not only promoting some of the biggest stars in the game. After all, the wrappers were based on all-star players from 1978. And even though you don't think of Ross Grimsley as an all-star player, he was a representative for the Montreal Expos in 1978, a 20-game winner for the Expos in 78. And it's a great way to promote the biggest names of the game. It's a great way for Topps to kind of repurpose its chewing gum, put it under the Major League Baseball brand, and, you know, push more product out the door. But it's also part of just some mystifying decisions that Topps made in the late 70s and early 80s. Now, if you've listened to the show for a while, you may recall a show that I did about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, where we just marveled at what Topps was doing with a special jumbo pack that it was selling back from 1979 to 1981. And they did it not only with baseball cards, but I know with football too. I don't believe they did it with basketball and hockey, but definitely baseball and football cards, where they sold a cello pack. And rather than just sliding, you know, that slab of gum in the middle of the pack, where 40 years later you would open it and then you would grumble because the bubble gum has just stained everything that it's touched over the last 40 years while in its original packaging. Topps packaged a cello pack without the gum and kind of in a blister pack exoskeleton, if you will. You had the cello pack on the top portion of the blister pack. And then on the bottom of the blister pack, you had a small pack featuring, I think it was three pieces of Topps chewing gum. So you had something that had gone hand in hand for, what, 30 years before, baseball cards and bubble gum. And this is a point in time where people are not buying the cards because they want the gum and the card was the throw-in. People were looking for the cards first, and the bubble gum was something that if you ate it, you didn't really enjoy it. And I thought Topps had this great solution. Hey, we still offer the cards and the gum, but if you don't want the gum, you can just hand off these individually wrapped pieces to somebody else. Or if you want the cards, you don't have to worry about the gum staining the cards or the gum being rock solid because the individually wrapped pieces tend to keep. In fact, when I opened the pack of bubble gum, I was kind of surprised. 40 years later, it was still soft. It wasn't really tasty, but it was soft. And that's certainly not the case if you open up just a standard pack of 81 Topps, and that's what the cello pack was. You open up a pack of 81 Topps and pull out the gum. You know, it's just like every other 40-year-old piece of gum. It's just this stiff, crumbly piece of, you know, pink cardboard, essentially. So I was kind of surprised that Topps had found this not only solution to the problems that having bubblegum on top of cards created, certainly in the condition of cards and the condition of the bubblegum too, it was basically inedible after the gum was sitting in that pack for 2 or 3 months. So you think Topps has that solution plus an ingenious way to grow the bubblegum brand and to create another revenue source and come up with something that Fleer and later Donruss could not replicate. Yet mysteriously, after Fleer and Donruss come around in 1981, Topps just puts the brakes on that kind of ingenious idea, and you didn't see it again. Now, Topps would eventually wrap the pieces of gum that came in card packs in later editions. And in fact, I remember the Heritage sets in the early 2000s, I want to say 07, 08, somewhere around there, included a piece of sugar-free gum, which was absolutely disgusting. Granted, it was fresher, but they included it in a little piece of plastic wrapping. You know, they just never really went back to that. And I always thought it was odd because the central piece of, you know, Topps chewing gum was just that, the chewing gum. You know, the bubble gum was still a revenue stream for them. And strangely, they decided not to, you know, use that anymore. So it kind of falls into that strange umbrella of experimentation that Topps was doing. They did a lot of it in the mid to late 70s. And I really think there was another missed opportunity here for Topps, not only in creating a revenue stream, not only producing more bubblegum and promoting it, but also a very smart cross promotion with Major League Baseball and the Players Association and some of the top names in the league. And you could have had kind of the side market of people collecting these wrappers. Well, people still collect the wrappers to this day, but this is where the fun ideas of 1979 crash headfirst into the price thought, condition sensitive world that we live in 2020. If you collect these wrappers, you can't get them graded by many of the professional grading sites. And it's mostly because the wax wrapper itself, there's no guarantee that once you put that wax wrapper into one of those hermetically sealed plastic holders from PSA or any of the other graders, that it's going to maintain its integrity. And what I mean by that is it's still not going to fall apart. I mean, it's wax. Wax is eventually going to flake off. So you may have this wax wrapper that's, you know, graded PSA 10, but in 10 years, there's no guarantee that that wrapper is still going to be in good shape. So what was intended to be this fun collectible is still fun. And to me, that's kind of neat. You know, what's old is new again. It's nature healing itself. We can't affix a PSA grade to this bubblegum wrapper. But I do think that it's a neat collectible. You can buy boxes of these bubblegum pieces, but the boxes are very expensive because they hold 72 pieces of gum. And because it is a 40 plus year old collectible, typically it's going to cost you $1 per piece of gum. So unless you want to drop $72 or more on a box of 40 year old gum that you can't eat, that might be a little too pricey. So if you want to explore the 79 Tops bubble gum, might I suggest that you go cruising through eBay. There are collectors who have hand collated these sets, and for basically $1 a wrapper, you can buy the entire set. So roughly $33 will get you the entire set. Some of the individual wrappers, depending on the player, will sell for upwards of a few bucks. So think of some of the big stars from the late 1970s. You could, you know, resell those wrappers for $3 or $4. But there's not too much of a market for this other than collectors who collect these kind of oddball things on the side. But there is an appreciation for it because it was a pretty ingenious product. And for whatever reason, Topps stopped making it after 1 year. So there is, I wouldn't say a scarcity to it, but a unique quality to it. And I think that's what makes the wrappers even more special. All right, from bubblegum to cards, you know, once upon a time it was bubblegum cards, but now we've got bubblegum and cards as they were separated in the 1980s. Of course, Donruss tried to put their disgusting bubblegum with their cards in 81, and Topps put a stop to that. That's a good court procedure, by the way. So Topps had the bubblegum market. Donruss and Fleer had to get innovative. And it wasn't just with their base sets or, you know, Fleer putting stickers in their packs and Donruss putting puzzle pieces in theirs. You had to think outside the box and come up with some different products. And one thing that Donruss did quite often, in fact, they made a few sets in the mid to late 1980s, was by taking the All-Star team, the All-Star subset of cards, and not just putting out a subset, but making them mega size, basically 3x5 postcard size. And those are the types of cards that you find in the packs of the 87 Donruss All-Star pop-ups. And to bring in somebody that's got a little more information and I guess I could say advice about some of those pop-up sets, dare I call him an expert, but anybody who goes out and buys each and every one of these cards in these sets and then reviews them is definitely an expert in any sense of the definition. We are pleased to be joined by Mike Summer of WaxPackHero.com. Mike, thank you so much for joining us here on Wax Ecstatic. Really appreciate you taking some time out today.
Hey, I appreciate it. Big fan of the show, so I appreciate you reaching out and asking me to join you.
And you actually reached out to me a few weeks ago. I was, you know, obviously promoting a lot of the upcoming shows, and I mentioned that we would be talking about the 87 Donruss All-Star pop-ups. And you said, hey, you know, I've, you know, written about these before, and you wrote a great piece on WaxPackHero.com about some of the various All-Star sets that Donruss put out in the mid-1980s. Before we dive into those sets a little bit, introduce yourself to our listeners here. Tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do and what you can find at WaxPackHero.com.
Yeah, sure. My name's Mike Summer, and I've been collecting since I was a kid, but like many of us, took a big break from the college years on, you know, into my early career years. And in 2015, found my way back into the hobby and was blown away by how much had changed and how different things were in 2015, 2016 than they were in the mid to late 90s when I had stopped collecting. And as I got more and more into it, one of the things I realized was things are so expensive now, I was going to need to figure out a way to generate some funds to help cover the cost of what I wanted to collect. And so I ended up starting the blog waxpackhero.com to kind of both celebrate the hobby and business sides of collecting and help share some of the lessons I was learning to help other people figure out what had changed, what things are like now, and how you might be able to buy and sell some stuff to raise some funds. That started to get some traction. I was having a lot of fun doing that, writing about some of the old sets that I collected as a kid, what some of the new sets were, how I was buying and selling on different platforms. And ultimately, late last year, I said, well, maybe I can expand this and start a podcast as well. And so I started the Wax Pack Hero Sports Card Minute last December, and now approaching a year onto that, but just having a ton of fun kind of celebrating the memories as well as helping people figure out how to generate some extra funds to help cover the cost of their collection.
And you talk about the adjustment, and it really was a different world. You know, if you stopped collecting, let's say, in 1995, well, now 20 years later, you get back into the hobby, and it's something completely different. Now, I don't think it's quite Austin Powers-esque. Of course, that was a 30-year gap, you know, while he was, you know, taking his little Rip Van Winkle turn. But it really is a little jarring when you get back into it and you're trying to make sense of, you know, some of the changes. What was the most difficult adjustment for you, or what was the biggest surprise when you got back into it and just something that totally took you off track from what you expected?
I think for me it was the cost. And so when I stopped collecting, I mean, you were buying boxes of cards at Sam's Club or whatever for $15. Or, if you were paying full price on a box of cards back then, it was $25 or $30 maybe. And now it was $50 or $100 or $200 or $250. And the other big difference is when I was a kid, you know, there was the four or five major sets, and everybody I knew tried to build a whole set and was a set collector. And now there's this focus on autographs and jersey cards and those types of things. And that was a big shift for me to realize that I can maybe still try to put together one or two sets a year, but I can't try to put together all the sets. And then along with that, the exclusive licenses that we have now for the different sports was something that was brand new as well and took some adjustments to get used to.
And the good thing is, of course, there's no wrong way to collect. So if you're still somebody who likes, you know, hand collating sets, then that's basically what you put your focus on. And that's actually, I think, Mike, one of the good things about the changes is because of the exclusive licensing, because things have been kind of funneled down a little bit. If you want baseball, you go to Topps. If you want football, you're going to Donruss. If you want hockey, you're doing Upper Deck. And you know, if you focus on a particular sport or a particular way of collecting, it is still quite doable. But you're absolutely right, because of the rise in prices, you've got to kind of coordinate it. You've got to find out, okay, what do I like to do best? And, you know, what's the best way for me to get that done? But I'm glad to hear that you're back in the hobby. And I know something that you've done is collect some of the Donruss All-Star, the big All-Star sets from the 1980s. And I want to talk just briefly about the sets. And, you know, in particular, I'm looking at 1987, but there's some commonalities with many of the sets that they put out in the mid-80s. But just the definition of fun. And it just seems like Donruss thought in the 1980s, starting in 1983, all right, boys, how do we get the edge on the competition? All right, what do we make that is so unique and fun and people are going to line up to buy it? I know, let's just make them bigger. All right, great job, great idea. You know, there's a laughable simplicity to it. Hey, let's just take our cards and make them super ginormous. All right, let's go with that. What are some of the traits of those big all-star cards that you like from the 1980s, and what kind of history and perspective can you provide for our listeners?
You know, one of those aspects that really came through is that we were just talking about of how much is different now is their there really is a realization for me that there is something in this hobby for everybody, whether that's vintage, whether that is modern new cards of your favorite players or with the autographs and relics. You know, those are all things that you can track down. But for me, what I found myself enjoying more and more were some of these oddball type sets, the food issue sets, and cards like these jumbo-sized Donruss products that they put out. Things that weren't necessarily mainstream just started to be fun to me to try to track down and piece together. And so for these jumbo cards, you know, Donruss wasn't the only one doing that. Topps had super cards, like I think they called them Topps Supers in 1980, as well having jumbo cards through the mid-80s. But these Donruss cards with the Action All-Stars were just a lot of fun. You know, they had been making cards for 2 years now, and like you said, wanted to try to do something a little bit different to supplement that mainstream release, and so they started to come out with these sets. 1983 was the first year that they put together the Action All-Star set, and you know, it was a 60 card set. There's about 38 packs in a box, 6 cards in each pack, and they retailed for a, you know, comparable 30 cents to what they were doing with their other sets. And they really, I think, used some of these sets as a way to experiment a little bit. You know, they had the puzzle pieces in there. Many of these Action All-Star sets used a different puzzle than they used in the flagship release, which was kind of cool. In 1984, the second year, that was not a lot of people realize, but that was actually the first time that we had a color player photo on the back of a card, was on the 1984 Donruss Action All-Stars jumbo cards. So there was, back in the 70s, there were some black and white photos that Topps experimented with on the back, but in 84, Donruss put the first color photo on the back of a card, which is kind of a cool piece of trivia. And they experimented with 2 pictures on the front in some years, 1 picture on the front in other years. They used puzzles as inserts, and then, as you've kind of referenced and are bringing out with the 87 conversation, the last 2 years of this run in 86 and 87, they actually used the pop-ups as an insert card in these packs, which was another kind of cool innovation.
Mike Sommer of WaxPackHero.com joining us here on Wax Ecstatic. And you bring up the pop-ups, and one thing I like about the pop-up, too, again, it's just a simple, fun idea. And it's inexpensive, too. You know, there's, yes, a little more cardboard that has to be put into the item, but it's simple. You pop it out, you adjust the flaps a little bit, and in the case of 1987, you've got Action All-Stars with the backlit roof of the Astrodome in the background. And, you know, the term tchotchke, you know, makes it sound like it's cheap and kind of silly, but it's a great tchotchke. It's a fun thing when you open it up. You just prop it up on your desk, or if you have a collection of them. It's just a neat little thing there. Were there any pop-ups that stood out? Because I know you were hand-collating all these sets here, but any pop-ups or any surprise All-Stars that you found in some of these packs as you were putting it together?
I think for me, one of the things that I like, especially about 87, was they actually put in the 2 managers in 87, and they didn't do that in 86. That was kind of a 2-card expansion in 87, was to put those managers in, which is kind of fun. I know how much you love manager cards, and so I'm sure those are your 2 favorites.
And by the way, in the 4 packs I opened, I not only got 2 Whitey Herzog cards, but 2 Whitey Herzog pop-ups. So we will be talking about Whitey Herzog later in the program.
That is funny.
Yeah, and, you know, sadly, too, and this is an interesting story, the American League manager was Dick Houser, who was the Royals manager. And it was actually at the 1986 All-Star game where Whitey Herzog realized something was terribly wrong with Dick Houser, because when they came out to exchange the lineup cards, Houser came out and didn't have a lineup card, and he totally forgot why he was even out there. And of course, as it would later be revealed, he had a brain tumor, and it was a terminal condition. He would die just a few months later. But it is interesting, even though it is the dreaded manager card. Yes, that is the bonus. And like I said, we'll be talking about Whitey, who does have a lot of incredible stories. But yes, I am flush with Whitey Herzog cards from the 1987 set. Now, Mike, 87 was the last year for this particular set. Is that correct?
Yes, they ran from 83 to 87.
Now, why do you think, as a jumbo set, why do you think that came to an end? Because it seems like Donruss had something that was neat. It was different. It was something they could play with. And it was something that was easy to collect, you know, a subset of 60 cards. And especially if you're getting six in a pack, at least in the early days, it doesn't take a whole lot to pull it all together. It just seems kind of odd that they decided to pull the plug. Why do you think they did that?
For me, I don't know of any confirmed reason that I'm aware of, but I'm going to just have to assume that, like any business, they did the examination of the sales and the profit and loss of that product line. And it just wasn't carrying the weight that some of the other products had.
And I'm sure, too, collectors balked at it, because even though it was an easy and neat set to put together, as we all know with 89 Bowman, anything that was not the size of a standard baseball card, or should I say a standard baseball card top holder or plastic page, you get my drift here, it became a pain in the butt for people to collect. So if you've got these postcard size cards, unless you were getting them just for the purposes of autographs, you really had nowhere to put them. They were kind of hard to store. But, you know, that's kind of the downside, too. As the competition increased in the mid to late 80s, you had to scale back on some of the more creative boutique items, if you will, to try to shore up the base set. Of course, Donruss produced the 88 set, and, well, the rest, as they say, is history. All right, Mike Sommer from WaxPackHero.com, just a couple more minutes here. What are your thoughts about some of your favorite throwback sets? You did mention like some of the food sets, and obviously you've got a passion for these jumbo all-star cards that Donruss put out. Share a few others that collectors may be interested in and exploring in if they've got a little disposable income and a little extra time to go searching around for these beauties.
Sure, yeah. So, you know, I really like these Donruss sets from the 80s. The Donruss Highlights box sets were fun. They did a Champions jumbo set in 1984 that was pretty cool. But from a more vintage look and feel, the MSA food issue discs from the late 70s are some of my favorite things to track down recently. So, MSA had a license for using the player names, and they partnered with a variety of vendors across the country to put together these circular player discs in the late 70s. And so you've got brands like Chili Willy, Zips, Wendy, Holiday Inn, Caesars, Red Barn. There's about 14 different, Crane was one of the more popular ones. There's about 14 or 15 different brands in 1976 and 1977 that have these baseball discs. And I've been having a lot of fun tracking those down too, because it's so unique. You get to see this branding and logos on the back of the card that's straight out of the 70s. And they're fun, but not overly expensive either. And that's right in my sweet spot. I'm trying to find some of these fun, unique items that aren't going to break the bank. And so I would encourage people to check out some of the MSA discs from the 70s.
That's very interesting. And I'm sure the chase is fun, too, because anything disc-shaped that's over 40 years ago, it probably ended up getting chewed up by the family dog, or it's on the roof of the neighbor's house. So there might be a little scarcity. So is it fun, you know, tracking these down, not just because they're unique, but they're a little hard to find in some places?
Yeah, I think so. You know, and like you had mentioned, they're not standard cart size, so they don't fit nicely in a shoebox or a Velveeta box or all of those other things we used to store cards when we were younger. And so they're sometimes a little bit harder to track down in good shape. Plus, they were so regionally based, depending on where you're at, it can be harder or easier to find certain versions of those.
Well, awesome. So we'll keep an eye out for those. I'll offer up my 2 cents. I had fun opening up just a few pieces of the 1979 Topps Major League Baseball chewing gum for the All-Star player wrappers. Do not eat the gum. It is not worth it. You could actually build a small hut out of some of these pieces. They are that solid. But a lot of fun things and some offbeat items as well. Mike, once again, let everybody know where they can find not only your blog, but also your podcast, too.
Sure. So waxpackhero.com is the kind of main landing page. That's the hub. But you can find the Wax Pack Hero Sports Card Minute on Apple Podcasts or pretty much wherever podcasts are found. And my other main social media presence is on Twitter, and you can follow me at TheMikeSummer on Twitter.
All right, and that's SOMMER for those of you that are looking for him. And he's a longtime listener of Wax Ecstatic. I'm a big fan of some of the work that you've done, Mike, too, and especially on some of those off-the-beaten-path products. Sometimes we get a little too focused on the base sets or the sets that we all know and love. Sometimes you got to go off the beaten path and find some of these fun little quirky items. And I'm glad that we were able to talk about them today with a little bit of the spotlight on the Jumbo All-Star sets and the 1987 pop-ups from Donruss. Mike Summer, waxpackhero.com. Thanks again for joining us on Wax Ecstatic this week.
Thanks for having me.
All right, thanks again to Mike Summer, waxpackhero.com, for joining us and talking a little more about the All-Star big cards from Donruss in the mid to late 1980s, and in particular the 1987 Donruss pop-ups. Now, we will talk about a couple of the pop-up people. Boy, that's a tough one. Say that 8 times real fast. Pop-up people. Okay. Anyways, we'll talk about a couple of the pop-up people in just a moment, but let's talk about some of the players who were featured on the wax wrappers in the 1979 Topps Major League Baseball chewing gum. And the first one is Reggie Smith. Now, I was telling you about Reggie Smith. There is more in his legacy than just getting into a fight with Steve Garvey during his time with the Dodgers. In fact, he had a pretty interesting road to the major leagues. Now, Reggie Smith was originally born in Shreveport, Louisiana, but his family moved to the Los Angeles area when he was very young. And he went on to play sports at Centennial High School. He was an all-California baseball star at shortstop. Also, he was a top football player as well. And what was interesting about his course to baseball, while many people remember his time not only with the Dodgers, but also with the Boston Red Sox, he was originally drafted, or rather signed as a free agent, by the Minnesota Twins in the summer of 1963. Imagine that. If Reggie Smith played with the Twins, you would have had a pretty good Twins team in the late 60s with a very consistent bat of Reggie Smith and an incredible arm, too, as we will get into. Now, what diverted him from his time in Minnesota? Well, a couple of things. First of all, he was really considering playing college ball in 1963 after he graduated from high school. However, his father was very sick. And while his father wanted him to go on and play to college, at the same time, Smith wanted to help the family out financially as they were dealing with this hardship at the particular time. So he starts moving up through the Twins organization, starting off with Wytheville in the Appalachian League, but he was unprotected in an interleague draft. There was a first-year draft. This is before the amateur draft, which came around in 1965. So this first-year draft in the winter of 1963, the Twins leave him unprotected, and the Boston Red Sox swoop him up and add him to their farm system. So he starts moving up through the Red Sox farm system and makes his major league debut in 1966. It's a late season call-up, plays his first game in September of 1966, September 18th, to be exact. And just 6 days later, he would get the first 3 hits of his career, lighting up Yankee pitcher Fritz Peterson the first three of well over 2,000 hits that he would have. Now, of course, the Boston Red Sox were a pretty terrible team in the mid-60s, but that youthful movement fast-tracked to that legendary summer of 1967, where the Red Sox and actually a few teams in the American League were duking it out until the final day of the season. The Red Sox would clinch the American League pennant, take on the St. Louis Cardinals in a legendary World Series as well, a seven-game series, which the Cardinals did win. But the young Smith was able to make a name for himself as he slugged his way to a 425 mark in the 1967 World Series. Also had a 250 batting average, not so bad considering some of the pitchers that the Cardinals had on their squad at the time. He also had a couple homers in that series. Now, I mentioned Smith's arm, even though he was primarily an outfielder. While he was coming up through the Red Sox system, the Red Sox were actually toying around with the idea of making him a pitcher. And of course, this wouldn't be the first time an outfielder's been moved up to the position of a pitcher. Of course, my favorite player growing up, Dave Steeb, was one of those players. Edwin Jackson, another one. He was an outfielder in the Dodger system, and they decided to move him to the mound instead. And he had a very lengthy major league career as a pitcher. Well, Smith was held into the outfield, and of course the Red Sox were able to take advantage of that as he was able to have an incredible season in 1969 after slumping in 1968 a bit. In fact, he hit .309 in the season and had an on-base percentage of .368. Defensively, he was pretty sharp as well, and he would have a pretty solid few years in Boston in the early 70s. Now, he didn't exactly mesh well with the Boston Red Sox fans. I know, crazy African-American players having trouble with the Red Sox faithful, but there was also a lot of tension with Red Sox owner and noted racist Tom Yawkey, as there was just kind of this dark cloud over Fenway Park and African-American ball players at this time. So even though it was a consensus that the atmosphere in the clubhouse was just fine, there was a lot of animosity towards Yawkey, and also there was a lot of tension in the stands. And of course, with Smith playing in the outfield, he was subject to all sorts of taunting and objects being thrown at him from fans in the bleachers, and he did not like the experience, to say the least. So finally, in October of 1973, the Red Sox decided to trade Smith to the St. Louis Cardinals. So they trade him alongside Ken Tatum for Bernie Carbo and Rick Wise. Now, Carbo and Wise would be key players in the Red Sox 75 World Series appearance and some competitive teams over the next few years. But when you look at just the career of Reggie Smith versus Rick Wise and Bernie Carbo, you're wondering why the Red Sox were able to just dump him for really nothing. And the Cardinals were able to take advantage of him. And of course, Smith was able to adjust rather nicely to much friendlier conditions in St. Louis. And a lot of it had to do with the Cardinals having a very successful experience with African-American ballplayers, notably Bob Gibson and Lou Brock, of course, both sadly just recently passed away just a few weeks apart from each other. And he would have two All-Star seasons in St. Louis. Now, he was twice an All-Star in Boston, 1969 and 1972, but consecutive All-Star seasons in 1974 and 1975. And why not? Not only was he continuing to be a stellar outfielder for the Cardinals, but also an outstanding hitter, too. In 1974, pulling in with a .309 batting average, 100 RBI. That was the first time he eclipsed the century mark. In fact, the only time in his career that he would. And he followed that up in 75 with a .302 average. Now, the Cardinals were also going through a bit of a rebuilding phase in the mid-70s as well. So they decided in 1976, June 15th to be exact, they decided to trade him to the Los Angeles Dodgers for Joe Ferguson, Bob Dethridge, and career minor leaguer Freddie Tisdale. Again, basically giving this guy up for practically nothing. So the Dodgers get quite the steal there as they are moving in on trying to lock up a division title in 1976, and of course building a pretty dominant team in the late 1970s. Now, Smith would be an all-star with the Dodgers in 77 and 78, also finished fourth in MVP voting in both years, and was part of the 1977 and 78 World Series, as well as the Dodgers falling to the Yankees in both attempts. Certainly wasn't Smith's fault in 1977, batting 273 in the six-game series, not as effective in 1978, coming around with a 200 average. Of course, he's starting to age at this point in time. Despite the fisticuffs with Steve Garvey in the locker room, he was still able to string together some pretty successful seasons. An injury-shortened 1979 season where he still batted 274. Another all-star season in 1980 with a 322 average, but then his numbers started to decline notably in 1981 when he became a free agent and signed with the San Francisco Giants in 1982. That team also going through a rebuilding process, but he did have the honor of playing for Frank Robinson, who was managing the Giants at that time. Now, he would go on to a different Giants team to wind down his career in 1983 and 1984, going over to Japan to play for the Yomiuri Giants. And then his professional baseball career wrapped up after the 1984 season. Again, over 2,000 hits, career batting average of .287. Won a World Series in 1981 with the Dodgers, appeared, like I said, in three others in 67, 77, and 78. Gold Glove Award winner, by the way, back in 1968, seven times All-Star. And even though he was kind of chased out of Boston, he is a member of the Boston Red Sox Hall of Fame. That's actually pretty interesting. And while Smith could have continued to be a coach and worked his way up the coaching ladder in Major League Baseball, he actually took quite a different path there. He did serve as a coach and as an instructor in the minor leagues for the Dodgers for several years after his playing career ended, but he became a coach with USA Baseball in 1999, was also involved in the Pan American Games, the Olympic Games in the year 2000, and he runs a baseball academy in Encino, California. He's actually dedicated a lot of his life to helping underprivileged youth. So very cool thing there. Smith very easily could have just got, caught in the ladder, if you will, of coaching in the minor leagues and trying to crack it in the major leagues, but committing a lot of his life to young underprivileged players, which is awesome. Now, the other wax rapper that I decided to choose, which is not somebody that you would think would be considered an all-star, but he actually was in 1978, far away from all of the other ups and downs in his career, his incredible season, his best season, and that is Ross Grimsley. Now, Ross Grimsley was quite the character. Born in 1950 in Topeka, Kansas, his father, Ross II, played briefly for the Chicago White Sox in 1951. And even though his father had mostly a minor league career, clearly baseball running through his veins. Now, he was also an outstanding basketball player, attended college at Jackson State Community College in Jackson, Tennessee, and was drafted in the first round of the 1969 amateur draft. That would be the January secondary draft. And he was an outstanding pitcher, was very quick to move up through the Red system, makes his major league debut at the age of 21 in May of 1971, and he proceeded to have a pretty good start to his big league career. 10-7 in 26 starts in 71 with a 3.57 earned run average. 14-8 in 1972, 3.05 earned run average, part of that big red machine team that would lose to the Oakland Athletics in seven games in the World Series that year, and a pretty solid 1973 season, 13-10, 3.23 earned run average. Pretty good, although not dominant, but pretty decent strikeout to walk ratio, didn't give up a ton of hits, but I guess you could call him a ground ball pitcher. The other thing you could call him is kind of a long-haired, hippie, freaky child. Ross Grimsley definitely had a personality. And while the Reds even though they were the Big Red Machine and they were partiers, they didn't look like partiers. In fact, one of the running jokes of the 72 World Series was how you had the swinging A's and you had the facial hair and you know, they just looked like a rowdy bunch of guys with the A's, and the Reds looked a whole lot more professional. Well, Ross Grimsley would have fit in a lot better with the A's than he did with the Reds. And that's because he grew his hair out. He had this, you know, frizzy kind of white man afro going on at the time. He also wore turquoise contact lenses, so his eyes kind of, you know, stood out, to say the very least. And he just ran into manager Sparky Anderson, crossed paths with him one too many times. And Sparky was not a big fan of his. In fact, Sparky accused Grimsley of, you know, talking to witches and just getting into this weird stuff on the side. So he couldn't work for Sparky, and the Reds decided to trade him. So along with Wally Williams, he gets traded to the Baltimore Orioles for Merv Redmond, Junior Kennedy, a minor leaguer, Bill Wood, in the winter of 1973. Now, Grimsley has a couple of outstanding seasons in Baltimore. Goes 18-13 in 1974, a respectable 1975 season, but again, he's crossing paths with Earl Weaver. Of course, you know, you just didn't live a day in Baltimore if you didn't cross paths with Earl Weaver. So despite some combativeness there with Earl Weaver and going back and forth between the starting rotation and the bullpen, he was still a pretty serviceable pitcher in 1976 and 1977, and part of a very competitive Baltimore Orioles team that did make it in the playoffs in 1974, ultimately losing to the Oakland Athletics. But again, Grimsley was one of the best pitchers for the Orioles that year, had a pretty a stellar couple of outings with them. Now, he was one of many players who were granted free agency under new free agency rules in the winter of 1977. So he was able to sign what was then a pretty lucrative deal with the Montreal Expos, a six-year, $1.1 million contract. He signs it in December of 1977. The Orioles had been trying to trade him to get something back, but they couldn't complete the trade. So he signs with the Expos, and right off the bat, it seems like a winning acquisition for the Expos. He wins 20 games for them. Like I said, that was his all-star season. 19 complete games, 3 shutouts, 3.05 earned run average. It looks like everything is paid off. And it looks like Grimsley is going to be one of the many key pieces to an outstanding Expos team. And you think of Steve Rogers, you think of Gary Carter, you think of Andre Dawson, you think of just some of that talent that was with that young Expos team, that really exciting Expos team of the late 70s and early 80s. You think Grimsley's going to be part of it, but fate would have a different path for him. Really struggled in 1979, had a 10-9 record and a 5.35 earned run average. And then he was dealing with just an absolutely abysmal 1980 season, started 2-6 with a 6.31 earned run average. And then he was traded to the Cleveland Indians. And when you were traded to the Cleveland Indians in 1980, you might as well have just been stationed to Siberia, because it was just as, you know, desirable. He was traded for Dave Oliver and basically just left to rot in Cleveland for the next year and a half. And that's pretty much what he did, actually, as I'm looking at his stats here. 1980, going 4-5 with a 6.75 earned run average. Didn't even play in the major leagues in 1981 at the end of that contract. And he gets released by the Indians late in the 81 season, signs as a free agent with the Baltimore Orioles in 1982, and completes his major league career in a rather not impressive way here, a very lopsided 1982 season. So that's how Ross Grimsley's career would wrap up. 124 wins to 99 losses, 3.81 earned run average over the course of his career. Certainly not a bad career. Like I said, one-time All-Star, even in 1978 was kind of sort of in the Cy Young race in the National League. He finished seventh in voting. But for Ross Grimsley, that was about it. Now, other than having long curly hair and purportedly hanging around with witches, he also got in trouble while he was in Baltimore. In September of 1975, fans at Fenway Park, imagine that, giving Ross Grimsley a little bit of heckling. So while he's warming up in the Orioles bullpen dealing with this heckling, rather than just ignore it or heckling back, well, Grimsley just starts throwing baseballs into the stands, and he actually hits a fan who later sued Grimsley and the Orioles, and that certainly did not sit well with his reputation. And he also had some other oddities, to say the least. One is his nickname was Scuzz because of his grooming habits, or should we say lack of. He had this habit where he did not shower during winning streaks. And you can imagine in 1978, with 20 wins, a few of those had to be consecutive. So Ross Grimsley didn't stink on the mound, but he pretty much stunk everywhere else. Now, after his major league career, he was a minor league instructor for several teams, not only the Orioles, but also the Phillies, Braves, and Mariners. Minor league pitching coach for the San Francisco Giants organization for a while. He still lives in Baltimore, though, at last check. He and his wife have been residing there for a long time. Now, let's move on to another pitcher. This goes back to the Donruss Big All-Star cards, and I kind of made a joke about one of the All-Star cards in our packs, and that was Ken Schramm. And it just goes to show how bad the Cleveland Indians were in 1987, where their All-Star representative was Ken Schramm. And that's no disrespect to Ken Schramm, because he's played more Major League Baseball games and has appeared in more Major League All-Star games than I ever did. But he is definitely not the first person that you think of when you're talking about all-star players. But again, he repped the team in 86, appears in the set in 87, shows up in one of our packs. So let's talk about him just a little bit. Born in Grangeville, Idaho in 1954, like many of the ball players we've been talking about, he was a multi-sport star at Grangeville High School. In fact, he won 11 athletic letters, starred in baseball, football, and basketball. In fact, he was a quarterback and a damn good one, too. While he was drafted by the Twins in the 10th round of the 1973 amateur draft, he decides to go to college, accepts a scholarship at the University of Idaho to not only pitch for the baseball team, but to play quarterback on the football team. Now, get this. His offensive coordinator was Dennis Erickson, who had a pretty good career as a head coach later on. Also, his head coach at the high school was Ed Troxell, who had a pretty notable record as a head coach at many high schools in the Idaho and Washington area throughout the 1950s and into the early 1990s, I believe. He was just one of those legendary coaches who was there for decades. Well, Schramm was actually very well known as a quarterback, and he decided to get out of football and focus on baseball in his freshman year. He realizes that Idaho was running an option offense at that time, which tended to expose the quarterback to continual contact with the defense. Well, after he hurt his non-throwing shoulder in football, he decided, time to give it up here. So during his junior year, he focused on baseball by turning pro, and that is where he started working his way up into the big leagues. Now, it wasn't with the Minnesota Twins, however. By 1976, he was drafted again by the California Angels in the 17th round, is working his way up through their system, but in June of 1980, he is the ubiquitous player to be named later in a deal between the Angels and the Toronto Blue Jays. The Angels would send him to make up for a deal a week before, where the Angels got pitcher and noted head case Dave Lemanchik in exchange for Ken Schramm. So Schramm has the unfortunate duty of having to pitch for a pretty terrible Blue Jays team. Appeared in 17 games in 1980, 6 games in 1982, nothing really to write home about. And his days in Toronto come to an end when he is released in August of 1982. Now the Minnesota Twins, another team that is rebuilding at the time, decide to take a flyer on him, sign him as a free agent. And this is where he's starting to piece together a halfway decent career. But again, the Twins are not a halfway decent team at this time. He had a great year in 1983, his first year with the Twins, going 15-8, 3.71 earned run average, starting 28 of 33 games. Struggled mightily in 1984-1985, so the Twins decide to dump him off on the doorstep of the Cleveland Indians. Again, you might as well have just been relegated to Siberia at this time. The Twins send him along with Brian Olkers for Ramon Romero and Roy Smith, a trade that probably not too many Twins fans or Indians fans remember. But at the time, it seems to make sense because, well, Ken Schramm turns into an all-star. He goes 14-7 with a 4.54 earned run average in 1986. Again, the Indians not exactly loaded with talent. They need somebody at the all-star game. He's selected, does not play in the 1986 all-star game in Houston. The wheels come off in 1987. 32 games pitched, 6.50 earned run average, 6-13 record. Of course, you could say the same for the Indians. A lot of people thought that they were finally progressing forward. They took two steps back, as the Indians often did back in the day, and he was released by the Indians after the 1987 season. So that pretty much sums up the playing career of Ken Schramm, but that's not the end of the story. After his Major League Baseball career ended, thanks in part to a shoulder injury, he served in the front office for the El Paso Diablos for a very long time, 15 years there. But he was also the first and only general manager and president of the Corpus Christi Hooks up until the end of the 2019 season. So even though he didn't have a very productive career as a player, he is technically an all-star, but he also was a longtime contributor to the front offices, first in El Paso, later in Corpus Christi, and very loved in Corpus Christi from everything that I've read about him as a general manager. Finally, let's spend a little time and give a little love to the dreaded manager. Yes, we have to, because not only did his card appear in two of the all-star big packs that we opened up, but his pop-up appeared twice. There is no holding down Dorrell Norman Elvert Herzog, better known as Whitey because of his bleach blonde hair. He got that nickname back in the 1940s when he was coming up through the Yankees farm system. Whitey Herzog is approaching his 89th birthday. Good Lord willing, and the creek don't rise. That'll happen on November 9th, born in New Athens, Illinois. And he had the hard life that a lot of children growing up in the 1930s did, as his father worked at a brewery, his mother worked at a shoe factory, and guess what? While he's starring in high school as a baseball and basketball player, he's holding down a whole bunch of other part-time jobs too. In fact, he sold baked goods out of a truck, he delivered newspapers, he worked at the brewery with his father, and he was a grave digger. Yes, the grave digger, Whitey Herzog. He was scouted by Lou Maguolo of the New York Yankees, who also scouted another Midwesterner, some kid named Mickey Mantle. You may have heard of him. And he eventually gets signed by the New York Yankees. He has to serve some time in Korea in 1953. Eventually comes back stateside, gets traded by the Yankees as a prospect, and he eventually gets some major league playing time. First with the Washington Senators, second with the Kansas City Athletics, third with the Baltimore Orioles, fourth with a declining Detroit Tiger team in 1963. Suffice to say, Whitey Herzog's playing career was nothing to get excited about. He played for a lot of really bad teams. He did okay at the plate, .257 career batting average, but Herzog would often go back on this quote here where he said, "Baseball's been good to me since I quit trying to play it." So like many successful managers, and you can go Sparky Anderson, you can go Tony La Russa, you know, there's a lot of notable managers who had very pedestrian playing careers, but were outstanding coaches. I think of hockey too. Scotty Bowman had a very brief playing career, a near fatal injury as a player, you know, took a pretty severe injury to the head. Yet, I mean, he's got more Stanley Cup rings than he does fingers. So, you know, sometimes it just happens. You have success as a manager, just not as a player. And that was the case with Whitey Herzog. Now, after his playing career ends in 1963, he gets into the front office, first as a scout with the Athletics in 1964, becomes a coach in 1965. And really the pivotal turning point for Whitey is 1966. He starts as a third base coach for the New York Mets under manager West Westrum. But he then became the director of player development, part of a six-year tenure in that position. And he was the guy who oversaw the onboarding, if you will, of several key players in the Mets system, especially John Matlack, Ken Singleton, Amos Otis. There were many others that came up. And after Gil Hodges died in the spring of 1972, right before the start of the season, there were many thoughts that Herzog would become the manager. However, chairman of the board, M. Donald Grant, selects Yogi Berra, who is then a first base coach, to be the manager. Well, understandably, Whitey Herzog sees this as just an absolute lack of respect. He thinks he's earned this position, so he leaves the Mets in November of 1972 and signs a two-year contract as the manager of the Texas Rangers. Now, the Texas Rangers were an absolute laughingstock of a team, and of course, Whitey Herzog had to be the ringmaster of this terrible circus in Arlington, Texas. This team was just cruising to a 100-loss season, and that's all part of, you know, bringing in young talent and trying to build a young team and trying to build it up. Well, the Texas Rangers ownership, Bob Short, who was not exactly the smartest guy in the room, although he would tell everybody he was, just decided to pull the shoot on Whitey Herzog. Just fires him late in the 1972 season, or 1973 season, excuse me, because Billy Martin is available. In fact, Short legendarily said that if his mother was managing the Rangers and Billy Martin was available, he'd fire his mother. During Whitey Herzog's tenure there, he was also witness to the destruction of David Clyde's career before it started, as Short, looking to sell tickets, drafting the local phenom high school pitcher and just throwing him right into the major leagues. And of course, Clyde never really was able to recover from that, only had a couple of halfway decent seasons and a very brief major league career, of course, blowing his arm out along in the process. So it was really just a train wreck in Texas. After the Rangers experience, he gets a chance to be an interim manager in 1974 with the Angels, but then most notably gets hired by the Kansas City Royals. He manages the team to three consecutive Western Division titles, 1976 through 78, but he doesn't really see the success until he goes cross state, goes east on I-72 St. Louis. He becomes the Cardinals manager in 1980, and thus comes the dawn of Whitey Ball. Now, what was Whitey Ball? It was all the rage in the mid-1980s, these typically National League teams playing on AstroTurf, big National League stadiums. It was all about pitching. It was all about base stealing. It was speed. It was small ball to the nth degree. And for Whitey Herzog and the St. Louis Cardinals, it worked. Helped him win the World Series in 1982, a seven-game series against Harvey's Wallbangers, the Milwaukee Brewers. Also got the Cardinals to a World Series in 1985. Of course, Whitey getting tossed out of Game 7 of the World Series just at that time, becoming the second manager to get tossed in a World Series, ironically, alongside Billy Martin. And that, of course, was following the Don Denkinger screw-up in Game 6 on the Jorge Horta hit that allowed the Royals to come back in Game 6, and then the Royals torched the Cardinals in Game 7. Not only did Whitey get tossed in that game, but also that's the legendary Joaquin Andujar just pummeling a toilet in the Cardinal locker room with a bat after he got pulled from the game. So coming up short in 85, coming up short in 87 as well, another epic seven-game battle with the Minnesota Twins. But still, throughout the 1980s, the Cardinals were one of the most competitive teams throughout the entire decade. And he would continue to be the manager of the team throughout the 1980s and into 1990. Now, he left the Cardinals after the 1990 season, actually resigned midway through that season after a very slow start. And He briefly ventured into the upper management, was the general manager of the California Angels in 1993 and just for a few months in 1994. But he was basically really, really bad at managing, most notably letting star players such as Dave Winfield and Wally Joyner get away and signing over-the-hill free agents like Von Hayes, Kelly Gruber, Gary Gaetti, basically guys that were well past their prime. And that really did set the Angels back for a few years. Of course, Joyner still had a couple of productive seasons in Kansas City. Winfield would go on to win a World Series with the Blue Jays in 1992 and would, in fact, continue to play for two or three more years, got 3,000 hits eventually. So, like I said, Herzog, great manager, but just could not equate that success in the front office. Now, he was a candidate to become the Boston Red Sox manager going into the 1997 season, decided to turn down an offer. The Red Sox hire Jimmy Williams instead. Boy, that's another legendary decision there. And eventually, Whitey Herzog basically just decided to throw in the towel on the idea of, being a manager ever again. Now, he was elected into the Baseball Hall of Fame by the Veterans Committee back in 2009, so he's inducted in the summer of 2010. The St. Louis Cardinals have retired the number 24, which he wore as a manager of the team, and he is still noted to be an expert that people call on when remembering those great days of the Cardinals in the 1980s. He's also a member of the St. Louis Cardinals Hall of Fame, I should say. And also, anytime you bring up the 1985 World Series and Don Dinkinger screwing the St. Louis Cardinals out of a should-be out at first base, you always have Whitey Herzog and his bleach blonde buzz cut popping up on your television screen somewhere. Well, how do you like that? Pop-ups. We're done with pop-ups here, as we had a fun look back at the pop-up all-star cards, the big all-star cards of Donruss from 1987. And thanks again to Mike Summer of WaxPackHero.com for telling us more about some of those all-star sets in the mid-1980s. And we also had fun popping some bubble gum. Actually, I didn't pop any gum. It was just rock solid. I wasn't even going to try to pop that. But if it was 1979 and you have this Topps Major League Baseball chewing gum, it would have been fun to pop as you're reading, glancing over those fun all-star comic wrappers that were included. And again, that may be something that you may want to pursue, maybe not trying to buy boxes of the bubble gum because they are a little pricey, a little hard to find. But if you go shopping around for the individual wrappers, there's only 33 in the whole set, you can assemble yourself a literal all-star team of great players from the late 1970s, and it won't cost you an arm and a leg. Like I said, based on prices I've seen, averaging about a dollar a wrapper. So if you're in that market, you got maybe $30 to $50 to spend, might be a fun thing for you to collect. And of course, the all-star big cards are still floating around from Donruss from the mid-1980s. Those are relatively inexpensive to find as well. All right, we've got another podcast coming our way again 2 weeks from today, Friday, November the 9th. We're going to be taking a look back at the Leaf Studio set and the 1992 Leaf set as well, as we look at a couple of the premium sets from the early 1990s. And again, I'm really excited to open up the studio cards. It's been a while since I've done that. And those were some pretty classy cards back then, and we'll see how they have aged nearly 30 years later. Don't forget, you can send us a cash donation. It helps keep the program on the air, keeps the archives free for everybody, and helps us buy the products that we talk about. You can do a cash donation, paypal.me/waxecstatic, or you can make a cardboard donation. Just send me an email, mattsalmonsays, that's S-E-Z at gmail.com. Let me know what you're thinking, and if there's a good match there, we'll work something out. And don't forget, our Twitter timeline is open 24/7. Talk about the sets, the players, anything about the hobby, any show ideas you have, you're more than welcome to share them with us at Wax and Gum Stains. Don't forget, please, don't take the foot off the pedal in fighting coronavirus. Please, the numbers are going up. You can make a difference in keeping them down. Wash your hands, wear your mask, practice social distancing, please. Let's keep fighting this together. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks for joining us on Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.